The church in Corinth was beset by people coming in who claimed to have big seminary degrees. They claimed to have a lot of credentials. They claimed that they had special revelation. And they claimed that Paul was a second-rate guy that was ugly looking, had weepy eyes, was not as highly credentialed as they were, that they needed to not pay attention to him, but pay attention to them because they were so much better than he was. And Paul was not anxious to get himself into a argument about his credentials, but on the other hand, he didn't want his sheep or his children being led astray by these people. And so he spends some time talking about his apostolic credentials and then begins to talk about the fact that he does not, that he foregoes his rights nonetheless. So in verse chapter 9, verse 1, he says, I'm on page 42. Should be on 1 Corinthians 9, 1, lesson 10, top of the page. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? If so, if to others I am not an apostle, at least I am to you. For you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. So he lists here many apostolic credentials to show that he has many rights, which he chooses to forego for the sake of God's people. Is he not a freedman? Is he not an apostle? Should he not have liberty? Has he not seen Jesus face to face? Did he not lead these people to Christ? Are they not, in fact, his handiwork? If you want to say, I am not an apostle, I at least was an apostle to you, because before I came, you did not know the Lord. I led you to the Lord, established your church, set in your elders. My defense to those who examine me is this. Do we not have a right to eat and drink? When he says we here, he means me. Barnabas and I, the people in his traveling team, do we not have a right to eat and what he ate and drink? And part of what he's saying here is, don't we have the right to have provision or sustenance provided for us? Do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? A little information here. He said, shouldn't we be allowed to bring along a wife on our trip at your expense? Shouldn't we be allowed that? And he said, would say, because after all, Peter brings his wife along. And the brothers of the Lord, James and Jude, when they travel, they bring their wives along. And the other apostles, when they travel, they bring their wives along. So why, don't we have that same level of right? Paul didn't have a wife, but he's saying, don't we have the right? These guys all bring their wives along, can't we? If I bring Barnabas, can he not bring his wife along? He said, or do only Barnabas and I have, not have the right to refrain from working? In other words, must we come in and work for a living and these other people are traveling on your dime? You pay them to come and go. And we are the only ones to have to work for a living. So he continues to defend his rights as an apostle compared to other apostles. Should he not be provided his sustenance as he labors among them? Should he have to buy his own food? Should not his wife also be provided for due to his ministry? Should a pastor's family not be supported by his congregation? Are only Paul and Barnabas required to support themselves? Paul frequently made tents to support himself, and only the Philippian church supported him while in Corinth. Now, he asked whether or not he should not be able to to minister among them without having to work, but at the same time, he refuses to take offerings from them. And that's at another place in the same letter. And one of the reasons is because he does not want to feel like that he can't apply the stick when he needs to. If you have a adversarial relationship with your people and you're dependent upon them for your daily bread, it makes it more difficult for you to say what you need to say. More importantly, in the ancient world, he who pays the money is the patron. And he who receives the money is subject to the patron. And in this particular case, Paul wanted to be free from being subjected to them. He wanted to be a spiritual patron to them and have them feel that way toward him as opposed to him being their hired man. Now, in the case of Philippi, among the Philippians, he has a different group of people there. The Philippians are actually not very wealthy. The Corinthians have money. The Corinthians are Alpharetans, okay? And the Philippians, you know, they're not very wealthy people, but they're humble toward Paul. And so they do send him offerings. They send him offerings while he's working at Corinth in order to support his ministry. And he accepts offerings from the Corinthians while he's working in Corinth, but he won't take any money from the Corinthians. Now, he's asking this question, should I not be able to take money from you? Is not a man worthy of his hire, etc., etc.? Are we the only pastors who can't do that? He's asking a question on a kind of a philosophical basis. He's trying to ask them, are we not qualified in every way to be your leadership, to be your eldership, to be your apostleship? And yet, he does not take their money because he wants to be able to say to them whatever he needs to say to them. Frankly, I personally understand this because I can get away with saying things that the church pastors can't. Because you know, you guys vote with your feet. I make a living, so you know, I don't have to worry about what I say. But I promise you that pastors find it very difficult at times. If you want to see a man of courage, look at Steve Wood. You know how many times he's talked to you about money in the last couple, 3 or 4 months? And you know how hard that is for a pastor to do? I mean, you know, everybody keeps saying, well, we're tired of hearing about money. Well, that's true, but we're also tired of seeing our church in debt and not being able to make our payments. And the truth of the matter is it's our church. We're responsible for it, and we need to do that. You got 7,000 members, of which about 3,000 show up on a regular basis, I suppose. And you got 400 giving units. You know, I mean, 400 people are giving something. Some of those people are actually tithing. It's a disgrace.
Just now, what are you saying? Are you saying that 400 people out of the 3,000 are actually putting money in?
400 giving units. 483, I think, was the number. Are actually putting money in. No. So the point is that you've got a whole bunch of people who just show up for church and they enjoy it all and whatever and comment and, you know, criticize and whatever the case may be, but they don't feel any sense of calling whatsoever to participate financially in the deal. Now, they may throw a buck or 10 bucks in cash in the bucket, but no one throws the kind of money they ought to be throwing in the bucket in cash. You know what I'm saying? So, it is a mortal sin, if I can say that, in this Protestant group. It's a mortal sin for a church to be in debt. It should never happen, and frankly, we are remiss for ever allowing it to happen. You know, instead of building a big edifice on credit, we should have collected the money and then built the edifice, and not the other way around. But we didn't do that, and now we're having to go and catch up on all of that. And you know, when people give their money to the Lord, they acknowledge the Lord. When they fail to give their money to the Lord, they fail to acknowledge the Lord. And right now, everybody wants to be acknowledged by the Lord, because as time goes by, we're going to see that people are going to be more and more desperate to have the provision of the Lord. When money is and the economy is rolling, it's easy to believe that you don't need God because you got money. You know, I love this story about the atheist who's been arguing with people, you know, his friends, about whether there's a God, and he's late for an important appointment. And what happens is he's going, okay, God, if you'll just give me a parking spot here, I will acknowledge you. And about that time, somebody whips out, and he whips in. He said, never mind, God, I've already found one. You know, Jesus said this. He said, if you're ashamed to confess me before men, I'll be ashamed to confess you before my Father. That's what he said. Well, if we are ashamed to acknowledge God financially and to say to the Lord, all I have is yours as a gift from you, and my representative gift back to you is the tenth, the tithe, the first fruits. That's my representative gift back to you. Never mind the fact that all of it belongs to you, but the minimal required response to acknowledge God as our provider is 10%, biblically speaking. See, I can say that. I can say that, and you know, there'll be four next week, but that's okay. I can say that. because it's true. So the point is that when we get to the place where we desperately need God's provision, all of a sudden we won't want God being ashamed to take care of us. So anyway, it's just something to think about, but that's where our church is. And Steve gets up and he works it and he tries to put it in an understanding of relationship with the Lord and our responsibility for our fellow man. I mean, he's off on the take care of the church thing, and he's now off, you know, love God, love neighbor. Okay? He's off on the love neighbor portion of this thing right now. And of course, people are upset about it. They don't want to hear about money. And God doesn't want to hear about our complaints either, but he does. And he listens. So, anyway, Paul did not want to take their money because he did not want to. He wanted the freedom to speak to them in the way that was necessary for him to speak to them. And so he didn't take their money. But he did take money from the poorer, less well-off Philippians who sent their money because their attitude was right. Their attitude was right. Philippians 4:15, right there on your page. As you yourself know, Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel, after I departed from Macedonia, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving but you alone. For even in Thessalonica, you sent a gift more than once for my needs. In Acts 18:1, it says, after these things, he left Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a certain Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, having recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. He came to them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them, and they were working, for by trade they were tent makers. Paul was a very experienced tent maker. He grew up in Tarsus, and they made the big black wool tents there, the ones that most people wanted, the very nice ones there. Any rabbi was required to have a trade. In Israel, rabbis must have a trade of some kind or another. Many rabbis did not need to work the trade because their congregations grew large enough to provide for them. But a rabbi must have a trade, and he also must have a wife. Those were two requirements that were there. Paul's situation of being celibate and recommending celibacy was atypical. It's atypical because rabbis are supposed to be married. Because after all, how would they know anything about that if they weren't? He was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath and trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. But when Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself completely to the word, solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. When Paul and Timothy came down, they were able to make enough money so that Paul could work, could minister full time. And also when he came down from Macedonia, he probably was bringing these offerings from Philippi, which is in Macedonia. So, any questions about that before I move on? It typically seems that way, yeah. As a percentage. Prisca and Aquila were interesting people. They were Jews from Pontus, but they were actually living in Rome, and during one of the pogroms they got kicked out of there, and they had become Christians. They were really quite good at what they did, but they were also very skilled teachers, particularly Prisca, the wife. And she is known throughout the New Testament in a number of places as being a very fine teacher and someone who knew how to explain the things of God to people. So the three of them working together on tents every day, that's probably pretty interesting. You know, they're sitting around there talking about this and that, and what do you think about this and what do you think about that? And when you got called up into heaven, tell me what that looked like, you know? Well, I can tell you, but, you know, I can't go any further. They had a pretty good relationship. And later on, they go back to Rome because we encounter them again later in Rome. But for the whole time he was in Corinth, they labored together. Then he goes on, verse 7, who at any time serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat the fruit of it? Who tends a flock and does not use the milk of the flock? I am not speaking these things according to human judgment, am I? Or does not the law also say these things? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle out the ox while he is threshing. God is not concerned about oxen, is he? In other words, this is a metaphor, folks. He said, if he won't let you deprive the oxen of something to eat, then he shouldn't deprive, and this is Moses, remember, he shouldn't deprive the workers of God, the rabbis, something to eat. As the oxen is threshing, you know what he's doing? He's going around a big circle, dragging a big arm, which is grinding up, stuff. And so grains and things are falling at his feet all the time, and he is gobbling it up as he goes. Well, there were greedy men who would put a muzzle on him so that he couldn't eat the stuff that fell to the floor because they felt like the ox was eating too much. And Moses said, you can't do that. So God's not concerned about oxen, is he? He's concerned about us, about people. Or is he speaking altogether for our sake? Yes, for our sake it was written, because the plowman ought to plow in hope. The thresher ought to thresh in hope of sharing the crops. If we sowed spiritual things in you, is it too much that we should reap material things from you? If others share the right over you, do we not more? You're giving all of this, these free will offerings to these men who've come into the flock who had no, they were not slightly bit involved in your becoming Christians. And yet they've come in and installed themselves as great leaders, and you guys are giving them offerings. Nevertheless, we did not use this right, but we endure all things that we may cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. So he was entitled to financial support, but he chose to forego that right. Soldiers are entitled to get paid, and farmers entitled to eat their fruit, and shepherds entitled to drink the flock's milk. This is not just a custom and morally right, it's biblically right as well. The law forbids muzzling the ox. God was not just concerned about oxen and their food. This metaphor is about the treatment of human workers. Workers should hope to be sustained by their labors. If Paul sows spiritually into them, isn't he entitled to reap physical reward from them? Yet Paul forgoes this right by working for a living. We should then be willing to forgo our liberties for the well-being of other people. Paul gives up his rights for the sake of the gospel, so should we. Now what's happening is because Paul takes a humble position, people take advantage of him, and they treat him like he's a second-class citizen, because he does that. Do you not know that those who perform sacred services eat the food of the temple, and those who attend regularly to the altar have their share with the altar? One of the things that happened to these meats that were sacrificed was that the meats were then shared or eaten by the Levites and their families. I mean, part of how they got paid was in the meats. And he said, these people who perform these services at the altar, they eat from the sacrifice of God. Now, other people weren't supposed to, but they were, because they were the Lord's people, Lord's workers. So also the Lord directed those who blame the gospel to get their living from the gospel. He said, the Lord directed that. Now, when Jesus sent out the apostles in groups of two, and then said in groups of two, he said, don't take any money with you. Don't take any money with you. Don't take money that you'll need to buy food and supplies. He said, you go and you trust the Lord will provide for you as you go. And he said, when you run across somebody and they invite you to your house, then enter that house and pray the peace of God down on that house. And he said, if you get a better offer from somebody who's got a better table or nicer digs, don't go there. Stay where you were first invited, because these people cared enough about it that they did that. But he's saying to them, don't carry a bunch of money with you, because God will provide for you as you go minister. Now, Barnabas was a fellow who I have a lot of appreciation for, and Barnabas was a man who was wealthy. And so he paid his own way. In fact, he sold a very expensive piece of property on the Isle of Malta, and he gave it as donations to the people. And so he was a little different than the average bear. But that was not... He could get away with that. He had the money. He could do that. And so he did. So also the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel. But I have used none of these things. I am not writing these things that it may be done so in my case. I'm not writing to you to complain that you're not paying me, and therefore I want you to pay me. I'm not writing to you to complain that you're not honoring me, therefore I want you to honor me. I'm writing to you to tell you that it is so. For it would be better for me to die than to have any man make my boast an empty one. In other words, my ability to work among you at my expense for free is my glory, is my boast. I'm not taking anything from you, and as far as I'm concerned, it would be better for me to die than to deprive me of that scenario. As soon as Paul begins to take money from these people, all of a sudden they're expecting to control him. You know, we have this bad habit of turning our shepherds into hirelings. It's wrong. It's displeasing to the Lord. It's non-biblical, and yet we do it. You know, and one of the reasons why we sometimes don't get the word of God is because we treat the man of God poorly. And I don't mean just financially. I'm talking about in terms of honor. You honor the man or the woman of God who is ministering to you, God will speak. You dishonor the man or the woman that God is speaking to you, and God will be silent. You have to relate to that person as if they speak for the Lord. They are the representative of the Lord. If you dishonor somebody's ambassador, you're going to be in trouble with the country whose ambassador you've dishonored. And if you want to honor the country, you honor the ambassador. So Levites and priests often consume the meat of the offering. Servants in the temple are also allowed to eat meat from the sacrifices. Now there were some sacrifices, there were immolations, which means that the entire corpus of the sheep or the goat or the ram or the chicken or whatever was consumed in fire. It depended on what the purpose of the sacrifice were. But many sacrifices were, they would just, you know, they would take the fat and the hides and the hooves and the certain of the entrails, and they would consume those before the Lord, which, you know, his cholesterol was in good shape, so it didn't really matter if he ate all the fat and stuff like that. And then the other stuff, after the blood, they would then give to the Levites to eat, and sometimes people themselves shared in the feast. It depended on the purpose of the sacrifice, the nature of a sacrifice. If you were having a situation, let's say you're Abraham and you're living out in the hills and there's no temple yet built, or you're somebody who's living in Galilee but you can't get yourself up to Jerusalem, and you want to celebrate a good harvest, well, you bring all your hired workers together and your family, and you know, you have a, what is that barbecue thing you guys have every year? You have a barbecue at your house, okay? So what you do is you kill this beast, whatever you're going to do, and you kill it kosher in the way that God respects, and you kill it in the name of the Lord, you offer it to the Lord, and you take all the fats and all that kind of stuff, and you consume them in fire for the Lord. And you know, the people talk about how great the smell of the offering is that goes up to God. And you start burning the fat, and it'll smell really good, you know. Fat is an anagram for flavor and taste. And if you take fat out of something, it will taste less flavorful. Okay. The Lord is saying, you know, take all of this stuff here and consume and offer this to me. It won't do me any harm, and it won't do you any good. And then the rest you can consume before me. There were three tithes that the people of Israel had every year. Three tenths. There was the tithe for the Levites. There was the tithe for the work of the church. And then there was the tithe of the celebration for God's blessing. And that third tithe was one they were told to take their tithe to Jerusalem and spend the month there feasting before the Lord. And so they did, from Passover to Pentecost. Now, sometimes in order to take the tithe there, it would have meant, you know, taking a herd of sheep all the way from Zebulun, which is up in the northern part of Galilee. And so what the Bible said for them to do was to sell all that and bind the money up into a sock and take the sock full of money to Jerusalem, and there in Jerusalem buy back all the stuff that you needed for the feast, and then to have a great feast before the Lord, celebrate it. So those month-long feasts where they came to Jerusalem and they would spend the month there, you know how traveling is, that was not inexpensive. So they would spend all of that money to celebrate before the Lord as a tithe before God. And in that list of the tithe, that particular tithe, it said, when you buy that which you need for the feast, buy the best. In fact, it said, you may have wine, you may have strong drink. If you want a good scotch, buy it, is what he was saying. Because he said, this is, you buy the best of everything to eat before me during this particular celebration, because we're celebrating the graciousness of God toward you. Don't come up here and eat saltines all month long, you know, trying to save a buck, you know. Don't be Jewish this month, okay? So it gives you a look into the nature of God. He wants us to celebrate. He wants us to have good things. He wants us to include Him in that celebration.
He 30%.
That makes 30%. Yeah, that makes 30%. They had. Then there was whatever taxes the Romans squeezed out of them. So I don't know. You might see them maybe having 40-50% all out. But if you go to Germany today, they have that as well. You know, huh? Yeah, that's right. So the only problem of it is we'll never see what it's being used for. So, all right. So you know, you remember that they cared for their poor, so the government didn't. They educated their children, so the government didn't. You know, they maintained themselves. You know, if you needed a road in, they put it in. You know, you can't expect, you know, the Roman road company to come down and, you know, Rome would build roads if they needed them for battle or if they needed them for their own purposes, or they would build aqueducts to bring water in for their own purposes. But for the common man, they wouldn't do anything like that. So whatever you had, you did for yourself. So servants in the temple are allowed to eat from the sacrifices. Pastors, therefore, may be fed, sheltered, clothed, etc. from the tithes. Paul has decided to forego these privileges, and he is not hinting that he should be supported. He said, if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast, for I am under compulsion, for woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. I can't go around and say, look how great I am, I preach the gospel. Because if I don't preach the gospel, I'll get spanked. It might be a nice way to say it. Because I've been sent to preach the gospel. I can't take credit for being all big benevolent because I come and preach the gospel. Because it's been assigned to me to preach the gospel. So I can't say, what a good boy am I. For I do this voluntarily, I have a reward. If I do it against my will, I have a stewardship entrusted to me. What then is my reward? That when I preach the gospel, I may offer the gospel without charge, so as to not make full use of my rights in the gospel. So Paul cannot brag about preaching the gospel. He's only doing his duty as God's bond slave. Remember, Paul constantly refers to himself as the bond slave, the captured bond servant. He is compelled by his calling, a divine commission. Woe to him if he does not preach the gospel. If he does this duty voluntarily, he'll be rewarded. If not voluntarily, he must obey the command in any case, whether he would volunteer or not. What reward can he receive if he's not voluntarily? Well, he may preach it at no charge and forego his right to a reward. That is his reward, to be able to do it for the Lord and not for the money. Then he will receive God's approval, not just as an acknowledgement of his obedience. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all, that I might win the more. So he started off by saying, am I not free? You remember earlier on. He's been talking about bond servants and all that sort of thing. But he's saying, am I not free? What he's saying is I am a bond servant, but I'm a bond servant voluntarily. I have submitted myself to be a bondservant to God. I do this willingly and gladly to be a servant to the Lord. So that's what he means when he says, I am free. And he says, I don't owe men anything because they're not making me rich. You remember in 2 Corinthians 2:4, he says, I'm not somebody peddling the gospel for money. He said, but I'm teaching people how to find eternal life. For though I am free from all men, I have made myself the slave to all men, that I might win the more. I have subjected myself to everyone, that I might be able to win them to God. And to the Jews, I became as a Jew, that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. to those who are without the law, as without the law, though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those who are without the law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. Paul says, you know, I have become all things to all men. It's what he's getting ready to say down here. He says, whenever I'm with people, I live as they live. I come among them as they are. I don't lord it over people. I don't try to put on airs. I don't try to flaunt money or anything. And if I'm around people who are rich, I'm okay with those people. I'm not going to have some sort of reverse sort of an attitude about them that they're rich and therefore they're scum. He said, I can relate to rich people. And he said, but I can also relate to poor people. And I can relate to slaves. And when I'm with slaves, I'm going to tell them, I understand, I'm a slave also. And when I'm with freedmen, I can tell them, look, I'm free. I'm free in God. I'm not, you know. So he said, I can relate to all people as they are. remember, Paul was a Roman citizen. So in spite of his conversation about being a slave, he actually had more rights than most Jews of his day. I consider myself a servant to everyone around me. I do this that I might win people. Blah, blah, blah. I think before I got there. To the weak, he said, I am weak to win them. I do not drink alcohol among alcoholics. He said, yes.
Did he have a problem taking advantage of the fact that he was a Roman citizen after he decided to...
No. No, if it was good for the gospel...
Putting down Christianity, and now he's...
No, if it was good for the gospel, he used his Roman... Paul did not consider... I don't consider my citizenship in the United States, which is openly hostile toward my teaching,
No, I'm thinking maybe the Romans would want it. Kirby's.
Are you kidding?
No. Uh-uh. Okay. No, I'm not kidding.
All right. Well. All right. First of all, let me say this. Most Romans couldn't give a flip what Paul was saying. To them, it was all nonsense. They thought of Paul and all of them. Paul's battles were never with Romans. His battle was with Jews, who were fighting him, religious people. And whenever Paul came before Romans, and they got to understand what the real issue was, they would go, this is some silly argument about their religion and about some guy who's supposed to be dead but now is alive. Remember that? From the middle of Acts? You know, whenever he got in front of Romans, you know, they might see if they could get a bribe out of him, but other than that, they couldn't care less. And when Paul found it necessary, he could take a beating with the best. But when he also found it necessary, he could say, by the way, I'm a Roman citizen and you just struck me in the mouth. In which case, three centurions messed their drawers and ran and hid. Because to strike a Roman citizen was death. Was death. And that happened to him twice. Where he said to them, is it lawful for you to strike a Roman citizen? At one particular point in time, the soldier who struck him said, well, I purchased my citizenship with a great deal of money that I won in battle. And he said, I was born a citizen. And the guy cut and run. He begged and said, I'm so sorry and excuse me and, you know, don't pay attention to the name on the badge because that isn't me. So, no, Paul would use his Roman citizenship when it furthered his aims and purposes in the gospel, and then he would ignore it when it was not important. And the Romans couldn't have cared less, because his father was a Roman citizen.
But his father was.
Yeah, I mean, it's always the father. Okay. Mothers don't have those kind of rights.
So it was his father.
His father was a Jew also.
Yeah.
But and probably his father before him was a Jew who was a Roman citizen. People got to be Roman citizens. They won it sometimes because of rewards, or they bought it and they paid for it or whatever. But I mean, we're having this little argument in this country right now about who is a citizen who's born here. You know, if you're born here, are you really a citizen of the United States just because you're born here? Well, the Romans didn't have that issue. If you were born as the son of a Roman, you were a Roman citizen. Regardless, so... Okay. Verse 22 continued, I have become all things to all men, that I may by all means save some. And I do all things for the sake of the gospel, that I may become a fellow partaker in it. Do you not know that those who run the race all run, but only the one receives the prize. So all the people in the race are running, but only the guy who wins receives the prize. Do not, though, run in such a way that you may win. And everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So the athletes among us go through great lengths to, you know, buffet their bodies. Or I think buffet their bodies. They go to great lengths to muscle up and train and everything because they want to win. And what they want to win is a laurel wreath to put around their heads or a gold medal. Okay, we compete to win an eternal prize. And he said, therefore, as we, if we're going to relate to ourselves in the metaphor of an athlete, we should be willing to compete, train at the highest level, and do all that we can to win, because our prize is not imperishable. He said, I become all things to all people so that I might save them. If I am all rich in my attitude and behavior, and I'm among poor people, you know, and I tell them, just do the right thing, you know, whatever. They're going, yeah, well, you know, you're loaded. You can say that. And so he says, I become irrelevant to them. So he said, when I'm among the poor, he said, I point out to them that I have no home, I have no purse, I have no regular job, that I'm dependent upon God, and that I don't need the trappings of wealth to make me happy. When I'm around rich people, he said, I don't, you know, act like being poor is, you know, makes me better than them. I can talk with rich people just the same as anybody else. They want to talk about stock, I can talk about stocks, you know. They want to talk about the market, I can talk about the market. I know how to do those kind of things. So I'm whoever I'm with, I'm relating to them on their level. I mean, if you're talking to children, you talk to children. You use metaphors they can understand. This is one of the reasons, you know, when you go to Africa, if you're going to a country that doesn't speak English, you're going to be a lot more effective as a missionary if you use a language they can understand. You're not going to be near as effective if you insist that they learn English so that I can lead you to the Lord. You know, that doesn't work, right? Well, try to then visualize, if you would, what it means for people who are out to try to win the Lord, the world, to Christ, concerning the music we use in church and the metaphors that we use in church. One of the very good reasons why people have contemporary worship is because if you're trying to bless the old saints, do the old hymns. But if you're trying to win the lost, then use music that they can relate to. Okay? If you go into a church and someone says, did you lift your Ebenezer? You know? I mean, there's probably not a whole lot of Christians can tell you what it means to lift your Ebenezer. And yet our that's what our hymn talks about, that, right? And lift my Ebenezer, okay? So, you know, explain that to me. How about if you're in a group of people and they don't know much at all about the whole thing of Christ and everything like that? All they know is that we're sitting here with a cup drinking the blood that pours from his side. How's that for you, you know? We've just got our cup out there underneath that blood spout from this side, that flow that flows, and we're just drinking it down, we're sucking it down, because it's making us pretty. Now, you know, you talk about the rappers saying stuff that's silly. You know, how do you think that comes across to the person who doesn't know those metaphors and what they mean? I mean, to me, the flow of Christ's blood is a very precious thing. But to the average person, it just sounds weirder than anything, you know. And so, I understand when people like, I mean, we go to the 8 o'clock service, and it's all hymns. Bob Dylan plays all, you know, hymns and stuff, and I enjoy it. We have a background that enables us to really like the hymns, and I've played them on my guitar for years when I've led worship, and I always play hymns. I used to play them a little faster than some of them I've heard, but we're not always going to funerals. So, you know, but I love the hymns. The hymns taught us and reinforcing us a lot of doctrine. If you know your hymns, you'll know a lot of theology, because the hymns teach us things. But I'm prepared to understand them. They're a language I understand. And so when I'm around people who are out in the world, and they've never, you know, they've never been. I mean, remember what we said about Paul was out talking to the Jews, and then he had to go talk to the Gentiles, and the Gentiles weren't in any way, shape, or form whatsoever able to understand all of these Jewish metaphors. And so he had to retool his gospel, including the description of the Messiah, the Lord and Savior, away from Christos, away from the Anointed One, in order for them to understand. So it's fine for us to have a preference for certain kinds of worship. And if we're talking about taking care of me, then we need to go there. But remember, if our goal is ever to reach out to other people, what do we do at Christmas time? We go out and we whip together this enormously beautiful Christmas pageant with all of this, these beautiful Christmas carols and all this stuff in it. Many of us know that many of those Christmas carols actually come right out of the hymnal. But the average person on the street doesn't know that. So what happens is that we play music that will draw them. So, you know, we're going to have this big music festival here at Christmas time. So go out and tell all your friends we're going to do an entire night of hymns in Latin. You'll really like it. We're going to chant. And, you know, there's going to be incense and whatever. Y'all, come on. You know, you'll dig it. Paul said, I will be whatever I need to be, you know, given that it's godly. I will be whatever I need to be to anyone I'm trying to reach. If I am with farm people, I'm talking farm stuff. I'm using farm metaphors like Jesus did. If I'm with shepherds, I'm using sheep metaphors like Jesus did. If I'm with soldiers, I'm using soldier metaphors like Jesus did. If I'm with priests, I'm going to use priests. If I'm with Jews, I'm going to use Mosaic references. If I'm with Gentiles, I'm going to talk about running the race and getting a crown and all the kinds of things that he does. That's what makes the Gospel of Luke so different than the Gospel of Matthew. Because Luke is written by Gentiles to Gentiles. Luke has to explain the Jewish terms. Matthew doesn't explain his Jewish terms. And he doesn't use any Gentile terms. That's what makes them, that's part of why they're such different animals. Anytime somebody takes an argument like that about Christ to someone who doesn't understand that, if it works, it's only because the Holy Spirit anointed it.
Exactly.
It's not because it is just so convincing.
No, it's also stuck.
Yeah. Remember, I've talked about this before, but Strobel, what's his first name? Lee Strobel? Yeah, Lee Strobel is very convincing to people who already believe. But if you give your Lee Strobel book to some real dyed-in-the-wool agnostic, he's going to go circular logic. You know, you're assuming the premise. You know, blah blah blah. Pff, you know, it's an internalized apologetic. It means nothing to me. Makes no sense. Doesn't prove anything. So we get all excited, you know, when. But it doesn't prove anything because it needs revelation. The best way that missionaries down through the centuries have worked is by their lifestyle because of their godliness. I mean, if you read the story, for instance, of the Spanish missionaries who came here and lived among the Indians, it was the ones who died bravely and the ones who lived among them and the ones who nursed them in the middle of their cholera and that sort of thing that had the impact on them, not the ones that came in and said, we are Spain, we've got conquistadors, and you will become Christians. You know, let me explain it to you because you're stupid. Of course, your culture is about 10,000 years older than mine, but you're ignorant. Okay. The most effective missionaries that I'm aware of have been those who've actually been not just preachers. They've been nurses, they've been farmers, they've been those kind of people. Mali, I think, used to be called Zaire, and before that it was called the Belgian Congo, right? Yeah, I think that's right. And there was a family of missionaries from Wilmore, Kentucky, called the Law family, Paul Law and his family there. And Bewley Law, who was the father, he was actually a guy who was brilliant at making or building anything. And he built them a hospital, and he built them houses, he built them a church, and he built them a water system, and those kind of things. Those people actually had a lot of influence on them. All right, so Paul says, I do everything for the sake of the gospel so that I may partake in it. In a race, only one is crowned the winner. I run to win, so should you. It requires self-control to win any sport. Athletes work hard just to win a perishable prize. We should work hard for an imperishable one. The Isthmian Games, held every 5 years, athletes trained full-time for 10 months. The training was famous for its rigor. Corinthians were well aware of these things. The athletes were not paid to train. They provided for themselves. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. But I buffet my body and make it my slave, lest possibly, after I've preached to others, I myself should be disqualified. I buffet my body quite a bit, actually. Since I plan to win, I take careful aim. In a boxing match, I hit hard. I do not just pound the air for show. Of course, usually the thing he's boxing against is his own ego. Usually what I'm boxing against is my own self-will. I work out physically so I'm strong enough to win. I bring my body under control instead of it controlling me. I do not want to have preached to others and find that I am disqualified because I have failed to do what I preach. First Corinthians 10:1. Now you remember that these designators of chapters and verses and numbers are all artificial, because he starts off with the word for, which is Greek, the word gar. And what it means is that what I'm getting ready to say relates to what I just got done saying. For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea. And King James says, I would not have you ignorant, brethren. Or I would not have you ignorant, brethren. You know, so I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. So God took great care of the Israelites in the desert, fully committed to them. They were under the protective clouds by day, the pillar of fire by night. You realize that these people lived in basically a climate-controlled environment. They wandered for 40 years in the desert, and without the assistance of the Lord in this manner, they would have frozen to death and they would have burned up in the day. They passed through the sea, being baptized, therefore, into Moses. So their journey through the sea, when the waters parted, was being baptized into Moses, he said. Moses had a relationship with God, and they were included in its benefits. So in the same way that Jews benefited from having a relationship with Abraham, they also benefited from having a relationship with Moses, because both Moses and Abraham had a relationship with God, which means that most of them didn't have one. They had a relationship with Moses or with Abraham. They all ate God's miraculous manna and drank his miraculous water. They were spiritually feeding and drinking from the rock of God, and Israel was God's Yeshua and his chosen one, his beloved. So Israel was selected or chosen by the Lord, but the rock from which they were drinking was the pre-incarnate Christ, the Messiah. The rock that they were, you know, this whole image of Jesus as the rock, which we'll get to in just a minute. In the Bible, the rock is a descriptor of God's salvation. In Deuteronomy 32, but Yeshurun, the beloved one, means Israel here, grew fat and kicked. Then he forsook God who made him, and he scorned the rock of his salvation. They made him jealous with strange gods. They made him, that's a capital H, him, they made God jealous with strange gods. With abominations they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons who were not gods, to gods whom they had not known, new gods who came lately, whom your fathers did not dread. You neglected the rock who begot you, and you forgot the God who gave you birth. Now this is Deuteronomy. This is Moses speaking in these terms back in Deuteronomy, right before he died. 32:30. How could one chase a thousand, and two put 10,000 to flight, unless their rock had sold them? So in other words, he said, your capacity to win these miraculous battles was because your rock was with you, and their rock had sold them out. The Lord had given them up. God had given up these people that you put to flight. Indeed, their rock is not like our rock. Even our enemies judge this themselves. And once again, this is Moses using these metaphors. Psalm 18, the Lord is my rock, my fortress, my deliverer, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised. I am safe from my enemies. When we are living in a time when the storm rages, we want to be built upon the rock. We want to hide behind the rock. One of the images that I really love is Moses saying to God, Moses and God are good friends and have become very good friends. And Moses is saying to God, I would really like to be able to see you. We've been talking, you're a voice. I would so much like to be able to see you. And God says, if I were to show you myself, it would destroy you because your iniquity is, you're not clean enough yet. You're not holy enough to be able to stand or withstand seeing me. We have to stand before the Lord, for God, washed of our sins by the blood of Christ in order to be able to do that. Now, Adam and Eve would do it because they hadn't fallen. But Moses, who is a great man of God, is nonetheless unwashed. He's not born again. He does not have the Holy Spirit. Okay? And so he says, it would destroy you to see me. Our conversations with the Lord, our ability to talk with God and have fellowship with God, far exceed those of anybody in the Old Testament. Now, Moses and Abraham had a pretty good lick at it because they were very dedicated to it. But the average person in the Old Testament, they didn't have anywhere near our access. You know, and if you talk about Abraham, you know, you've read the Old Testament, you think Abraham and God met every Saturday night. You know. But the truth is they had 10, 12 encounters in their whole lifetime. In his whole lifetime. He lived 175 years. He had 10, 12, 14 encounters. It wasn't like it was all the time. He could go years without hearing from the Lord. I was going somewhere. Where was I going, Nancy? Oh, I know what it was. So, Moses says, I would like to see you. God says, you're not capable of surviving seeing me. But he says, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, I will hide you. I'll split this rock over here and put a big cleft in it. I'll hide you in the cleft of the rock, and then I will pass by you, and you can kind of get a glimpse of me going by. That much you can handle. And of course, when it happened, Moses goes down, and his visage is so changed that he scares the people. They require him to wear a mask over his face because he is so terrifying because of his interface with God. Now, you're talking about hymns and theology. Rock of ages, cleft for me. Let me hide myself in thee. You see, what we're saying is that I want to be hidden in the rock which has been split for me. The rock which is Christ, which has been cloven in half for me, killed for me. I want to hide myself in the rock so that I can fellowship with God face to face. I need the protection of the rock in order that I might be able to fellowship with the Father. Rock of ages, cleft for me. Let me hide myself in thee. Water and the blood from my wounded side which flowed, be for me a double cure, save from wrath and make me pure. Yes?
You said that to the people, Moses was terrifying after his encounter with God.
Yeah, the Bible says that they required him to wear a mask over his face until the image... Until it kind of faded, till the glory of it faded, because he was fearful to look upon.
What do you think fearful means in
that case? I think it meant that when they looked at him, they saw the glory of God upon him, and they were afraid. I think you know, God, in order to allow us to fellowship with him, dumbs himself down a lot so that we can do that, okay? But God, in his purity, is awesome. The word fear and the word awe are the same word, okay? So, in fact, God is referred to as the fear of Isaac, okay? So, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom means not that we should be afraid of Him in the sense of being craven, but that we have proper respect for Him, okay? But, you know, did you see the movie, what was the Indiana Jones and the Ark of the Covenant movie? What was that called? Raiders of the Lost Ark. Do you see that movie? Okay. Do you remember at the end that he and his girlfriend, Karen Lane, they're tied around a post and they got blindfolds on? And you've got Belloc is doing this Jewish ritual and they're going to open the lid off of the Ark of the Covenant. And all they've got their cameras going and all these Nazis are standing around. And because Indiana Jones is a scholar, he says to her, don't look at it. Don't look at it. Under no circumstances, don't look at it. So, because he knows what's going to happen, because he's a scholar. Because he knows that every time the people got near the Ark of the Covenant, they opened it up or whatever, it destroyed them. They died. They died. They were executed on the spot, okay? By the energy that came out of the Ark, not by other men. You remember one time that the Ark was returning from having been captured by the Philistines. They had captured it, and they kept moving it from one temple to the other, trying to capture it. And they would go in, and they would find their gods on the floor broken, and they would find all these things are happening. And finally, they decided they couldn't handle the Ark of the Covenant. So they put it on... They asked their scholars to do some research in Jewish history and find out what they should do. So they put it on a new wagon with new... oxen that had never been ridden or something, virgin oxen. And so that's what they were told to do. So they did that and they turned it loose and it headed back to Jerusalem. And when David and them heard that it was returning, that on its own it was returning, he went down and they were having a poop-to-do and they were party and they were hula-ing because the ark was coming. And as they were going along, the oxen stumbled and the wagon tipped and the ark started to come over like this. And a man named Uzzah reached up to keep it from falling. And he did keep it from falling and God struck him dead. Because he touched the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant was meant to be carried on the backs of the Levites with poles. And David was careless. And David was mad at God because the Ark of the Covenant struck Uzzah dead. No, he was just trying to do a good thing. But it was David's fault because he was careless. So David had the ark taken to the threshing floor of a non-Jew who lived among them. And after a period of time, he saw that this non-Jew was flourishing, and he determined that the Ark of the Covenant among this guy was making him flourish. And so he decided that the Ark of the Covenant was safe again. So he came and this time brought it into Jerusalem, right? Well, in this movie, The Raiders of the Lost Ark, Belloc and these guys are doing all these rituals. He's reading Hebrew, he's reading the proper ritual words. He's dressed in the proper robe of the high priest. And so they're doing all this stuff, and these Nazis are standing around, and they take the lid off of this thing. And when they do, this amazing spirit comes up and out of this thing, and it goes all around, and all these people are going, it's beautiful, it's beautiful. You remember that? And then all of a sudden, it turns, and it becomes this incredibly nightmarish figure. And they become terrified, and as it goes through them, it melts them down. They just, every one of them melt. The cameras all fry up, and the whole nine yards, and it goes all around. And here is Indiana Jones and Karen Lane, or whatever her name is, Karen, huh? After Karen Allen, her too. They're tied to this post. they're tied to this post, and they've got these blindfolds on. And he is telling her, "Don't look at it. Don't look at it." And it's buzzing all around them to see what they're going to do. And he's telling her, "Don't look at it. Don't look at it." You know, and he's clamping his eyes shut because he knows. Okay. And so what happens eventually? This thing goes, and then it goes back in the Ark of the Covenant, and then the lid comes down, and falls on the top of it. Okay. Well, all of a sudden they realize their bonds have been burned off and they're saved. And there's nobody else around. Everybody else is water. Everybody else has been melted, whatever. Because Because God, if we approach God in unholiness, it is dangerous to us. God is not mean, He's just other. You know, 220 wire is not mean. But if you grab a hold of 220 wire without being grounded, it's going to fry you. And you can say, oh, bad wire, you know. But it's not bad wire. It's just the nature of the difference between you and that wire. And so it is the nature between us and God. So, I need to have a proper respect, even fear, of the Lord in order to be able to have fellowship with Him. One of the things that happens to us all too often is when someone gives us the privilege of fellowshipping with them, we suddenly get cocky and we start taking advantage of it. I'll give you another movie that shows this thing. Did you ever see the movie where Michael Douglas was the American president and Martin Sheen was his right-hand guy? It was the American, I think it's called The American President. Is that what it's called? Okay. So what happens is they're sitting around playing pool. And Michael, they're playing pool and they're talking about stuff. And Martin Sheen, who is his secretary of, or his, the guy who administers the White House, his chief of staff. He says to him, well, what we need to do, Mr. President, is this and this. And, you know, Michael Douglas says, look, how long have we known each other? 25 years? 30 years? He said, when we're alone here in the White House, he said, you can call me by my name. He said, it's okay. It's just the two of us. And he says, as you wish, Mr. President. In other words, he refuses to cross that line of respect while he's trying to do this particular job because he knows if he does, he'll get careless with it. He'll get too comfortable with it. So we have a sort of a balance between, you know, running and jumping in Jesus' arms because he's all sweet and lovely, and the fear of the Lord. We need both. You know, I mean, can you imagine somebody showing up at the throne of God and just running and jumping in his lap and going, how you doing, Jeezy baby? You know, does that strike you as being the right thing to do? You know what I'm saying? So a proper level of respect and humility requires us to approach God as if it's a privilege. And if He chooses to grant us the privilege of intimacy with Him, it's not because we deserve it. It's a great gift. Does that help? Yeah. All right. Psalm 18. For who is God but the Lord? And who is a rock except our God? Matthew 7:24. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts upon them may be compared to a wise man who built his house upon the rock. People right now who are basing their well-being on anything other than Christ are built on sand. They will not stand. No matter how strong or powerful they look right now, they will not stand. A wise man builds his house upon the rock. The rain descended, the floods come, the winds blew, and they burst against that house, yet it did not fall, for it had been founded upon the rock. 1 Corinthians 3, for no man can lay a foundation, or stone, or rock, other than the one which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. So we have this whole imagery here of Jesus and salvation as the rock, and Paul has been speaking of that, about them who were in the desert, and God washed them, brought them through baptism, and all that sort of thing, and fed them manna from the desert, and water from the rock. In other words, these people were very well positioned to be cared for by God, and so are we. We have been fed manna in the desert and water from the rock. We have all the same privileges that they did, more maybe. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. So he says, even though God protected them and did all this stuff to bless them and care for them, way of his way to care for them, they did not respond correctly, and he wound up, they all died in the desert. Their bones were laid low in the wilderness. These things happen as examples for us, that we should not crave evil things as they also crave. We should learn from this, that the chosen people were dealt with severely. What makes us think that we can skip the same sort of disciplines is because we think we're Christians. You know, we may give a lot of lip service to it, but, you know, Belloc can say all of the rituals in Hebrew he wants to, and he can wear the robes. But when it all gets done, he's going to be mush. He's just going to melt in front of the power of God. Do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. I think that there's probably as good a description here of our culture as you can get. That people sat down to eat and drink and they stood up to play. What are we about in this country? Entertainment. Pleasure. Eat, drink, and play. You know, weekends are made for Michelob. You know, on our, you know, our second or third boat. You know, in our third or fourth house on the second or third lake. You know, that's what we're here for, folks, is to have a good time. Nor let us act immorally as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. You think 9/11 was bad? 23,000 fell in one day. I don't know what you think. You're entitled to your opinion. But I clearly saw 9/11 as the hand of God. When God withdraws His hedge of protection from us, and He allows our enemies to harm us, you can blame the enemies, but it is God who withdrew the hedge of protection. You realize that since 1940, He had never allowed anybody to strike us? You think about that. I mean, you think about now, you got all these people who are out there trying to kill us and whatever. You know, and, you know, up until 9/11, they wouldn't dare. They wouldn't dare. I mean, there'd be a crazy man once in a while who would try to do something, but it would not encourage others. But when 9/11 came along, it emboldened the entire Middle Eastern structure to think of us as weak and impotent and without protection. And so now what happens is we're lining up and queuing up in the airports, and you know we're having to give away significant levels of our own freedom because we have not honored our God. Now, that's just the way I see that. It was a measured response. And the point is it could have been worse. And we've had more than one occasion when it could have been worse. And, you know, the thing about it is that we were warned 2 years earlier. Because that's one of the same imams that was involved in all of this, who lives in New York, had the blind guy. He had his followers to wrap the pillars of the same twin towers in the basement with a bunch of explosives, and they went off and didn't do as much damage because they weren't as good as a big airplane. They didn't get as much damage in. But, you know, that was several years before. We had warning. And we just said, you know, we just sort of like, well, you know, nobody can touch us.
1940, Hawaii was a territory, and it was the ships, not the land. When were we struck prior to 1940?
You kill our ships and you kill our boys, we've been struck.
Well, but it wasn't on our homeland, really.
I wouldn't accept that.
Anyway, what I wondered was, because you did that thing on history.
Yeah.
When prior to 1940?
When, let's see, 1812. Not much. Not much. We had a little run-in with... You can't remember, World War I wasn't fought here. World War II wasn't fought here. We had a little run-in with the Mexican-Americans in 1820-something.
That was a territory.
Yeah, but, and which is a distinction that I don't think is really... I mean, it's us. It's, you know, it's us, whether it's whatever. And if all that the Japanese had done was lowered a mountain or two, I wouldn't have considered it a big deal. They killed all those men. They destroyed our navy. One of the things. I mean, one of the things you got to remember is that we sat back and watched evil grow across the sea, and didn't want to participate. Didn't want to get in. We wanted to keep. You know, and you got to remember too that for all of our posturing, one of the nations that was the strongest against Israel at that time was the United States. It was, you know, Randolph Hearst was an open Nazi. Charles Lindbergh was an open Nazi. They had all of these, Henry Ford was an open Nazi. They had all of these German youth groups all throughout the country that they were lifting up. It was Truman that turned us, that forced us to turn the other way. And that was close. At any rate, neither here nor there. So, nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Now, these things happened as an example for us. These people sit down to eat and drink, and they stood up to play. Nor let us act immorally as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us try the Lord as some of them did, and were destroyed by serpents. Test the Lord, he said. Try the Lord. Provoke the Lord, and some of them were destroyed by serpents. Nor grumble as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. The destroyer is an angel of God that he sends out from time to time to wreak havoc upon the earth. Usually shows up in terms of famine upon the land, or hurricanes, or other things of that nature. It's something we talk about in the Revelation study a good bit. So even though they were blessed and chosen, they displeased the Lord. They were disobedient in the wilderness, and they all died there. They did not enter the promised land. This is a serious lesson to us, the redeemed, lest we fall away by coveting evil things. Let us not make the same mistakes: idolatry, immorality, testing God, and grumbling. The destroying angel is a plague, the angel of death in Revelation. Abaddon rules over the abyss. Apollyon is his name in Greek. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instructions, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. So all of these sins of the Jews were written down so that we would learn. You know, it wasn't because God wanted to embarrass them by keeping a written record. It was for our sake, so that we would learn. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation or testing has overtaken you, but such is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted or tested beyond what you're able, but with temptation or testing will provide a way of escape also, that you may be able to endure it. The word there we would typically translate as testing. God made an example of the unfaithful Old Testament Israelites as a warning to us. We dwell at the end of the age. We should be smarter. We have the Holy Spirit. We should behave better. Don't get cocky and think, I'm an upstanding citizen, or you will stumble and fall. God will not test you beyond the grace needed to win. Jesus, our high priest, ran the same course and won. When we can, therefore, ask God's grace with confidence. Hebrews 2:17. He, Jesus, had to be made like his brethren in all things, that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For since he himself was tested or tempted in that which he has suffered, he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. So one of the reasons, or one of the things that happened when Jesus became one of us, is he endured all the same, you know, wet pants, dirty diapers, hungry, colic, all that kind of stuff, working with his hands, you know, having getting disciplined at school. I mean, Jesus went through all this human life, and therefore we have a high priest who has been tested or tempted in every way as we are, and has mercy for us. He knows what it's like. Since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted or tested in all things as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and may find grace to help in time of need. It would not be a good thing if the angels were our judges, because they don't have near as much respect for us as Jesus does. I mean, they've never suffered pain. They've never suffered temptation. They don't have the kind of struggles that we do. They can't. They have a brain and no body. They have a soul and no, you know, you can't. You can describe hunger, but you have to feel it to know what it means. You know, we can intellectually describe pain, but without a body, you can't feel it. It's only an intellectual exercise. I mean, we talk about, for instance, things that we talk about people who die and what all they go through, And we can intellectually describe it. We can think, boy, that's awful. We have no clue. When somebody comes up to you and you've just lost your child or whatever, and they go, I know what you're going through. They haven't a clue. They haven't a clue. I mean, they mean well, but they haven't a clue. And maybe if they've lost a child, they have a clue. But that's all they have is a clue. Because no one knows what you feel or what your pain is. And Jesus was a person, a human being like us, and he suffered as we suffer. He had to submit and obey and live and die before God. And therefore, we're told by the author of Hebrews that we have a high priest who therefore loves us, cares for us, and understands in every way as we are. And so therefore, he is merciful. He's sympathetic. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as the wise men. You judge what I say. Doesn't this make sense to you? Is not the cup of blessing which we bless the sharing in the blood of Christ? So isn't that which we have, which is good, a sharing in the blood of Christ? Is not the bread which we break a sharing in the body of Christ? Since there is one bread and we are many, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. Look at the nation of Israel. Are not those who eat sacrifices sharers in the altar? What do I mean then? That a thing sacrificed to idols is anything? Or that an idol is anything? No. But I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. Only I do not want you to become sharers in demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake in the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? We are not stronger than he, are we? So we've got to live our life one way or the other. We've got to commit ourselves to walking with the Lord and aligning ourselves with God in all the areas of our life, or else we should just go out and be part of the world, because you can't do both. We're sharers in the blood of Christ. We're sharers in the body of Christ. We're all in this together. And if we do, offer ourselves to demons by the various practices, you know, when people get together in certain sort of settings and they dance and bob and yell and scream and they're half naked and they're all into sensuality and all that sort of stuff, they're worshiping demons. You know, they're worshiping demons. You know, they call it partying. They're worshiping demons. And people who worked down through the history of worship demons haven't always known what they were doing. But that's what they were doing. And we can't do both. Can't do both. It just won't work. So Paul is telling the Corinthians they cannot have their feet in both worlds. We need to flee from idol worship, which is so prevalent in our society today. In Moses' day, it was the worship of the calf and the gods of Egypt. In Paul's day, it was the pagan temple practices of the culture. In our day, it is the things in our life that draw us away from God. Moses' people had manna and miraculous water, but they sinned. Paul's people have the bread and the cup of Christ, but some still walk away from God. We have the bread and cup of Christ, but are we more faithful? Manna and communion bread are the same. Miraculous water and communion wine are the same. They speak of a covenantal separation of God's people from the rest of the people. Idols offered sacrifices are not real, but they are demonic in nature, luring one to Satan. Knowingly or not, Gentiles worship demons. We cannot walk with the Lord rightly when we worship demons in our living. We will provoke God to jealousy like the Israelites did in the desert. And you know what happened to them. I'm going to stop here. We'll start here next time. And
can I ask an easy question?
Yeah, that's why I'm going to stop. Abaddon, Apollyon, those are his names.
Apollyon?
It's right under there. It's right there.
Oh, that's how you pronounce it.
Yeah, yeah.
Abaddon.
Mm-hmm.
So he is the
angel of death. Mm-hmm. Yep, he's the keeper of the keys of death. I think that one of the big problems that we have in our life is syncretism. It's the mixing of that which is God with that which is the world. And it's subtle. It sort of creeps up on us. None of us are immune from it. It just happens. And we need from time to time to sort of ask the Lord to show us where we've got one foot in one world and one in the other. Some of us either have been or some people are in it in a big way. I mean, their foot's almost entirely in the world. But they go to church every Sunday and they claim to be Christians and whatever. And syncretism has always been the way that the people were destroyed. The nations sought to marry with the Jews, and when the Jews fell into that trap, they were led into astray. Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived, was led into idol worship by his 700 wives and his 300 concubines who were not believers. So we need to recognize that we need a good, clear separation from us and the world. We can be in the world, but not of it. We need to ask the Lord to show us that. You had a hand up. That's somebody pray us out.